ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Attention Please podcast. So today I find myself all alone again. Reminds me of my Jadavpur University days, different way, you know, of course. And so today I thought I would take some of your questions. So I had asked people on Twitter to send me questions based on the hashtag AskArnabRay. And so I'll try to answer a few of the questions within the time that I have. So again, the questions that I like that. I get a lot of questions from different topics. So in no particular order, let's start. So one of the questions that I got was on TMC election win aftermath. How will things go down to non-violent ways now that they have full dominance, and what happens to Mukul Roy? Again, I'm kind of become bored of talking about West Bengal elections. I wouldn't say bored, I'm just frustrated. Frustrated at talking about the condition of politics in my home state that will just doesn't seem to ever change, and it won't change. It won't change because I don't think that there is, and again, this is a point I've made many times before, that whether it was the first 35 years of CPM Marxist rule and then a rebranding under Mamata Banerjee, the essential nature of rule in Bengal hasn't changed. It is based on the total control of institutions by the party. So it used to be the CPM party, now it is the Trinamool Congress party, and this whole structure is kept in place by a system of I would say everybody eats at the bar, everybody drinks at the bar, so everybody gets a little bit of the share of the pie. Nobody gets too much and nobody gets too little, and if anybody wants more than what they're getting, then there is the threat of intimidation and the threat of violence. So the BJP, and I said that before the elections, I thought made many, many major faulty steps, did some things which I did not understand, which is, and I think the biggest thing that they did wrong was they essentially tried to cannibalize the worst of Trinamool Congress. And by doing so, they took anti-incumbency on themselves. Trinamool could wash their hands off some of their very obviously corrupt operatives, and they said, "Well, you know what? They're all working for the BJP now." And what's happened is now that the elections are over, they have all come back to the Trinamool Congress. So they took a slew of actors, the BJP, and gave them tickets to contest, and by doing so, they put them over the actual cadre who had been working there for years. So the local cadre who had been working there were suddenly found out that they were not going to contest the seat that they were trying for, and some other star or starlet from Taliganj was being flown in who had absolutely no connect with the local constituency, had no connect with the party, and they were just put there by the BJP think tank, which was again Mukul Roy. And Mukul Roy is a Trinamool Congress. He works in a Trinamool Congress way. And obviously, when you work in a Trinamool Congress way against Trinamool Congress, guess who's going to win? Trinamool Congress. And guess who gets called back into the party now that he has done his job? Mukul Roy himself. So it's hilarious that, you know, they had people who they just pulled out from nowhere, made them MLA candidates. They lost by a huge margin, and now 3 months later they've all left the party and gone back. I mean, they haven't gone to Trinamool Congress, but the thing is that if they want to work in Bengali movie industry, they have to toe the Trinamool Congress line, you see, because fascism and all of these things are for public consumption in Washington Post by Rana Ayub. This is where really fascism exists. Nobody's concerned about. Rajdeep Sardesai isn't concerned about fascism. The Bengal intelligentsia aren't concerned about fascism in their own backyard as long as they benefit from it. And the violence that has been unleashed against BJP candidate is proof of that. And again, you would find absolute silence from the Bengali intelligentsia. They don't say it this way, but I think their justification will be that whole Antifa thing. It's not fascist to be fascist to a fascist. So that's again, I can go on, but it's just like banging my head against a brick wall talking about Bengali politics at this point of time. So the next question I see is on UP Panchayat elections. I have really no opinion. I haven't been following that. Cabinet reshuffle. Again, there's really little. Cabinet reshuffles are what happens when there is reorganization within any company, where the new guy comes in and the new guy needs to show that there's some activity being done. I'm glad that Dr. Harshavardhan at least lost his job because he was terrible. And you know, if somebody has to be held responsible, you could say, well, the buck stops here with the prime minister, but let's be realistic, the prime minister is not going to resign. Just like in any company, when a product fails or when you have market share shrinking, it's not the CEO who gets fired, it's the VP of engineering who gets fired or the VP of sales who gets fired. So if that's sounds unfair, well, you know, it happens everywhere. So if you were expecting that Modi or Amit Shah would take responsibility, obviously they're not going to, but at least it's good to see the VP of engineering in this case being fired. And Babul Supriyo was, I mean, it's just another example of the BJP giving prominence to somebody who's absolutely ineffectual. And I would say is I don't know why they have kept him. And it's good, at least for me, it's good to see that he lost his ministership, because I think if Babul Supriyo has to be effective, the first thing he needs to lose is his arrogance and his "I'm a minister, my minister who are," he's ineffectual. He hasn't shown any kind of leadership. And if they're to salvage Babul Supriyo, then it's important that he not have that the arrogance that he has. I hope, again, I'm coming back to BJP and I'm coming back to Bengal, but I think that the BJP has to let Dilip Ghosh do what he wants to, because he's the only person there that they have who has a mass base and who got sidelined this election season again because of the people who had flown in from outside. And it's very obvious that Dilip Ghosh did not want the stars and starlets to be flown in from the Trinamool Congress. It was very obvious that he did not approve of any of this. And it's time that the BJP listened to Dilip Ghosh, because he is the only committed BJP activist that they have here who has been with BJP throughout. Mukul Roy, we've seen how that panned out. So again, I think I'm coming back to what I said I wouldn't come back to. Movie reviews. I haven't seen Haseena Dilruba, and I don't want to see Collar Bomb. The next question that I have is, again, a question that I've been asked several times. How do you find time for Twitter, writing, jobs, blogs, podcasts, and family all in the same 24 hours? So the obvious question is that, of course, something usually slides off the table. It's usually writing nowadays that slides off the table. Podcast also, I'm trying to limit it to half an hour. I feel the pressure of all these things, of juggling all these balls in the air. And now it's summer, so my daughter's at home, so there's other stuff to do. So it's difficult finding time. It took me like almost 3.5 years to write my cybersecurity book, and it's still not done, as in I still haven't. The publisher still hasn't sent me the edited draft, so I'll definitely have to take another pass, and there will obviously be some work there. So just means that my fiction writing has kind of gone on to the back burner. And again, those of you who listen to the podcast, you know that I've had my issues with Indian publishers. I've had issues with the publishing process itself. And again, it's not. I do like writing fiction. I started writing Shak Chunni again, wrote a chapter, and then I lost steam. This never used to happen to me before. I started writing and I would write and write and write. But nowadays I just can't seem to focus, and I just can't seem to, get myself in front of the computer and write chapters. And I don't want to also write when I'm not enjoying. And maybe that's because I feel that there's a better use of my time than writing something for which I don't think that there's much of an audience. And people will say, well, you don't write for an audience, you write for the joy of writing. But that's the biggest bullshit that this ever is. People always write for an audience. If they were just writing for themselves, they would just write in a diary. They wouldn't even post anything on Facebook. Everybody does it for an audience. And I will be honest enough to accept that I do too. There's another question after that, which says, what makes something a good story to you? Can a mystery be good without plot twists? Pick one, horror versus comedy. So what makes a good story? And this, again, this is a, one can go on and on about this, but trying to put it as succinctly as possible, what makes something a good story is something that holds my attention. And this is my problem with literary fiction, because most literary fiction doesn't hold my attention because they're not done to hold your attention. They're written as, this is good writing. This is, again, what they mean by good writing is this is what an English literature professor would consider to be good writing. So this is, so literary fiction is usually adherence to a standard of writing that is, to me, random and arbitrary and doesn't reflect. If it doesn't meet my standards of what a good story is, it's not a good story. So what is my standard of a good story? It's simple. It's anything which holds my attention. So if I find myself fidgeting, if I find myself moving away, if I find myself going back looking at my phone, then obviously this is not a good story. Because ultimately, when we read a book, it's not that I'm reading a book, that there is something inherently noble about reading a book. It's I have some free time and I want to spend it in the way that gives me the most amount of joy. We have only a few breaths that we have in this world. So reading something or watching something just for the sake of doing so is useless to me. There was a time in my life where I did it, where I labored through books or labored through movies because I felt that if I didn't do it, people would laugh at me and think that I'm stupid. But now I realize, well, maybe I am stupid. I don't care, but I still don't want to waste these hours of my life doing something that I'm not engaged in. So for me, any good story is something which engages me. And different things engage me in different ways. Some things engage me in the way that it makes me think. There's no question of a plot twist, but it just makes me think. It makes me imagine. I can imagine myself in that world. There are some books which grab me because of plot twists, some stories also catch me because the author is very clever. So I can see, wow, this is so well written. I wish I could write like that. And there's nothing genre specific. I do like to read in the thriller and mystery genre, but that doesn't necessarily mean that a good story has to be that. As I said, anything that holds my attention is a good story for me. So it's an interesting question. Can a mystery be good without plot twists? So I think, no, it can't be. But plot twist doesn't necessarily mean what many of us think is what the Abbas Masnanism. Oh, my goodness, I never saw that coming. But that's not what a plot twist is. As a matter of fact, if there are too many of those, then that's actually a bad narrative. That's actually what I would call an Abbas Mastan narrative. At that point of time, the fact that there is a plot twist itself is no longer the twist. You are expecting it. You know that nothing is as it seems. People who are dead are not really dead. People that say that everybody is an unreliable narrator. So none of what you read makes any sense. So at that point of time, it's not even engaging anymore, I would say, as a story. Because if the main thing is everything I could have said before is wrong, then why am I reading this? Even this sentence could be wrong. And so it brings me to Russell's paradox here. So it's not a mystery, but when I mean a plot twist, I mean something a little bit more gentle. I mean something that is surprising, about a character reacting in a way that you did not expect that character to, the story going to a location or the story taking a turn, not necessarily a red herring, but the story taking a turn that you did not anticipate. Now, again, as you become a more mature reader, your standards increase. And what does that mean? That means that you yourself know that, okay, here are the tropes of this genre. So I want to see something which breaks this trope. If it doesn't break the trope, then it's predictable. So really a good mystery is one that is not predictable. I wouldn't say that it needs to have a lot of plot twists. Pick one, horror versus comedy. Well, horror and comedy both are similar in many ways, in that we laugh because we encounter something which is not expected. If something is expected, then it becomes the Kapil Sharma show. So you don't laugh. And at least that's my definition. So with both with respect to horror as well as comedy, I kind of expect to be surprised. Now, of course, I love comedy, but there just isn't a lot of books that I would say I have found myself laughing out aloud. I do love, in terms of comedy, I do like watching funny things. I do like watching Saturday Night Live. But if you ask me about reading, it's usually horror and thrillers that I like to read. I definitely like to write horror, and I like to write comedy too. But in this day of cancel culture and the kind of mob-based thought lynching that has started, it's just impossible to write comedy in this day and age. So horror it is. Next question is, how do academics approach learning and how to keep a lot of things in memory? Well, I'm not sure I understand the first question. So how do academics approach learning? So I'll just leave that out because I really don't know what the question means. But how do you keep a lot of things in memory? Now, this is a good question in the sense that there's a school of thought which nowadays I find that children are not taught to memorize anymore. Like when we were growing up, we were taught to memorize a lot of useless things, like how much coal was produced by which district in Bengal. Now you could say, why is anybody spending time memorizing it? Why are people memorizing poems? And the answer that modern educationists give is that it's no longer necessary to memorize things. With the internet and with information being available at fingertips, you don't really need to memorize anything. You can just put the word in a search box and out comes the source material. So you don't really need to remember something in order to be able to retrieve it. And while there is some point to that, and there is obviously no need to memorize the amount of, the amount of total number of metric tons of iron ore produced in Orissa in the year 1986, I don't think that there is much use in the knowledge of that per se. But what I've also seen is that if you do not memorize, then your ability to remember, because this is just a muscle, the brain is just a muscle, there's everything else. So if you don't exercise your memory, you will not be able to remember. And why is memory important? Well, memory, and when I'm talking about memory, I'm not talking about, the memory that's needed in order to do our daily lives. But one of the things that somebody once told me was that Arnab has a very good memory of things that happened years ago. And how do you remember these things? And I remember those things because they leave an effect on me. Anything that leaves an effect on me. But the fact that they leave an effect on me and I can still remember them was because I had to memorize a lot. And so my memory muscle is way better than my triceps. And because I grew up at a time when there was a lot of memorizing. There was a lot of memorizing. And nowadays, I don't need to memorize anything, but it really helps. It helps because if I see something, let's say I'm in cybersecurity, I'm watching a video on the use of, let's say, Cobalt Strike, which is, again, a framework that is being used greatly in all these huge ransomware attacks that have been going on recently, the $70 million one, which they bargained it down to $50 million the last time I heard. But so I was watching, a nine-part YouTube series on Cobalt Strike. And of course, there was a lot of information. I'll be honest, I didn't understand about 50% of it because I'm not in that kind of cybersecurity red team pen testing, which is where Cobalt Strike is. Cobalt Strike is a penetration testing tool. But the reason why I was watching it was I was fairly confident that there would be things from that presentation that would stick in my memory. I don't know which one, the ones that possibly would make an effect on me, and I don't know what ones it would be, but some of it will remain because this is the way I've learned. And the utility is maybe 5 days down the road or 5 years down the road, there'll be something that I will be able to remember from that. And I would say, And when would I remember it? I would remember it when I see something similar. And I said, wait, I know exactly where I've seen this before. This is not new. This is something which has been done before. So in order for you to make these connections, there is the need for the development of your memory muscle. And I believe that children are growing up nowadays without that exercise. So per se, why would you need to remember a poem, or why would you need to remember the total number of metric tons of coal produced in Orissa in 1986? So the information per se isn't important, but the exercise of the brain is, I believe. And that perhaps is the answer to your question. So choose focusing something for long hours versus short bursts. I would always say short bursts because, again, I don't know the brain science behind this, but I would say that it's important that just like you want to do cross training, you want to mix up your exercise, you don't want to keep on doing the same things with different, you don't want to exercise the same muscle. You only want to do a certain number of reps, and then you want to move on to another muscle. This is no different. There's always short, intense bursts work much better than just long hours, because I definitely think that your brain, at least my brain, cannot focus on something for long hours. And unfortunately, as I grow older, it's not a question of me growing older, but you know, being on my mobile phone, consuming YouTube videos, I think it's definitely lowered my attention span. When I was 15 or 16, I think I had a much bigger attention span, much longer attention span than I do now, to my detriment. There's another question. Where did Rajiv Rai go? Would our Bollywood be any different if he had... Hold on, So I think the question, where did Rajiv Rai go? Would our Bollywood be any different if he had become as Chopra's and Johar? So I don't think there was, honestly, I don't think there was any, at least the way I see it, I don't think there was any, it was not an either or between the genre of Rajiv Rai and Chopra's. I mean, they both coexisted, action, thrillers. And I don't think that the genre of Rajiv Rai went away. It was appropriated by, Abbas Mastan. Again, Abbas Mastan's music didn't have that kind of music which really appealed to me. But other than that, and by the way, with respect to where did Rajiv Rai go, I think Rajiv Rai's Pyarish Mohabbat was a disaster. And then Asambhav was even a bigger disaster. I think there was also some incident with the mafia at some point of time. So I think that kind of led to him, totally going away from Bollywood. And I don't think that he can come back into Bollywood, because much as I love the 90s and much as I love the movies he made, I just don't think they're a fit in today's world. It's like why I don't want to watch anything made by David Dhawan in the 2000s. It's the same reason. The David Dhawan died in the 1990s. The one who lives is just another David Dhawan inhabiting that body. So there's a question of, if you found the purpose of your life, musings on meaning of life. So again, this whole notion of, and if anybody's listening to this podcast for the first time, you must be really surprised at how the topics are changing, like not in the same ballpark, not in the same universe, but we're like spanning multiverses of topics. So here we were discussing about Rajiv Rai and Pyar Ishq Aur Mohabbat and Asambhav, and straight from there we have gone on to the purpose of life, which with Arjun Rampal there is always that what is he on thing going on. But anyways, have you found the purpose of your life? Musings on meaning of life. So I don't think that, again, this is my own personal belief, I don't think that life has any meaning. Again, the notion of life having a meaning itself is a Western philosophical construct. It's a Christian construct. So it originally came from a very Christian notion of why we are here in the image of our Lord, and that our purpose in life is to do things that the Lord asked us to do, and then finally be one with God. Now, that is also, that's why there's a notion of purpose, and this whole in like last century before that, with Nietzsche and with skepticism, people realized that there might not be any God, which means there might not be any purpose to our life. And that's when you had philosophies like existentialism. And again, this kind of God-sized hole in our heart, that I think Nietzsche said. I might be wrong if Nietzsche said that. Somebody definitely said that. You see, this kind of crisis of faith never really occurred in Eastern philosophies, even definitely not in Hindu thought, because we've never looked upon our lives as purposeful in that sense. I'll quote what Gita says. The Gita is in many ways existential, in the sense it says that you are free to choose your actions, your karma, based on your moral code, which is dharma. And I've written an article about this once, so I'm not going to get into the details of it. So if you go by that, then there is really no purpose in life. The only purpose in life is at the atomic level, is at the level of your actions. That the purpose of life today is whether I watch this movie or that, whether I take this decision in my work life or that, whether I spend this time playing with my daughter or I spend this time playing with a book. So that is really the purpose of life, because there's nothing called life. The purpose of life and the decisions that you do are small actions that you take every day. And if there is any purpose to it, it's happiness. It is the fact that you felt contented. If you did not feel contented, then whatever action you took didn't serve its purpose. But coming back, I don't subscribe to the belief that your life has any purpose. And just because it doesn't have, your entire life doesn't have a purpose, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not worth living or it's not valuable enough. And this was again what the existentialist said. This was really the basis of the work of Camus, where he said, you know, if life has no meaning, why don't we kill ourselves? Because there's no meaning. And then he said, well, there's a good reason why we don't kill ourselves. And the reason why we don't is that it's the journey that's important. It's not the destination. There is no preordained destination. And as long as we're on the journey, have a good time. And that's the purpose of life. So I kind of tend to agree with that. Not in the ways that he framed it, because again, he is framing it from a Western philosophical point of view. And I don't think that I subscribe to that, by virtue of my own faith and beliefs. But essentially, yes, I think I get what he says. The other question that I see is, who would you prefer in 2024 to win, Raga or Modi? Serious question, given both the parties have their very serious flaws. So again, the easy answer is, again, the problem is Rahul Gandhi. The problem is him. This is a question that really has no answer. It's kind of a chicken and egg kind of a question. I'm personally not a BJP supporter. I wouldn't call myself a BJP supporter, though of course my opponents would say I am. But I'm definitely not a Congress supporter. I don't think any of my opponents or friends would ever call me that. So if an assessment was going to be, am I more a Congress supporter than a BJP supporter? Yes, I'm definitely more a BJP supporter than I would be a Congress supporter. But that's a very roundabout way of trying to put me into the BJP camp, which I don't think anybody should have to face. Which one do you hate more does not necessarily mean that I like the other one I'm endorsing. But if the choice, and again, the lazy way of out of everything is everybody's a crook. So everybody's a crook, everybody's inefficient, everybody's shit. So who cares? Oh, that's the lazy way out of any choice. The life isn't perfect. Whether it is who will be the prime minister versus who, what will you do this evening? There is no perfect answer. And one thing is there's nothing good on television anyways. And that's always the case. Even when we had one channel versus now we have a millions with streaming. So, but there's still nothing good on. So
taking that way out is, I think, a cop-out. So what I would say is that between Rahul Gandhi and Modi, if that is the choice that's facing us, it would have to be Modi, because the other choice is so bad. And I think that the choice is unsustainable, because Congress cannot form a party, cannot form a government by themselves. What's more important for me is a stable government, a government that can stand without being pulled by some of the more extreme elements in the Indian polity. That is what I really want. So more than Rahul Gandhi or Modi, what I want in 2024 is a stable government. A stable government that has some kind of ideological mooring. I may not agree with that ideological mooring, but it is not a government which is formed by a number of people who have nothing in common, who have no common vision, are just there to loot as much as they can in the shortest period of time, and knowing fully well that the government won't survive. So every second they have in their job is a second devoted to loot. So I'm not naive enough to know that and to assume that politicians are honest, or anyone is honest. But I believe that the dishonesty of politicians can be managed. That is also true. And I don't think that Rahul Gandhi is in a state of managing anything at this point of time. So between Rahul Gandhi and Modi, it will have to be Modi. And the regional parties, again, there's a third choice, obviously. There's regional parties, but regional parties, the regional party formation always has that problem. So that there is no unity. Mamata Banerjee will want her person to be the railway minister. I mean, that's really where they're coming from. They're coming from the ministries. They're coming for the spoils of power. They don't really, you may not agree with many of the things that the BJP government has done, but it had an idea of what it wanted to do. And for many of those things, they have actually done it. Some of the things they have tried to do, they haven't done that well. And some of the things that they didn't plan for, which was COVID, was they did a disastrous job of it. Ultimately, again, we've gone over that. They did a good job initially. Again, it was a good job initially. The left liberal media did not applaud when they did a good job. Then they did a terrible job and the left liberal media was all over it. But then you would have to ask, well, when they did do a good job, where were you guys? But again, that's not the question that you asked. The last question is, why do you think Indians in 2021 are still migrating out of India in hordes? 90s people called it brain drain. No such terms are used now, although numbers are much higher. And do you think migrating out is the best way? Now, migrating, again, the reason why, first of all, my decision to migrate out of India was a decision which was not taken when I left India. It was not a decision I'd taken even after staying here for many years. It was only very late in my, I would say around 2016, when I started applying to Indian universities for an academic position, to come back, is when I realized that I couldn't come back to India anymore. Not again, for me, in the world that is today, the notion, and when I say this, I don't mean this politically, but I mean in terms of the professional life. What does working in India mean? If you're working in India and if you're working on, and you're supporting a client in the US and you're keeping US times, where are you exactly working? So obviously you're working in India in the sense your salary is coming in rupees, but at that point of time, isn't it better for you to work in the US and get your salary in dollars? Because you're essentially working in the US. So in this day and age, the whole notion of where you're situated, really is, and then after COVID with working from home, it's again the location. What is location anymore? So I think the more important thing is, what kind of jobs are people getting in India? What kind of work culture is there in Indian companies? And is that the reason that's making people leave? And again, I cannot claim to speak for Indians, far less for anybody other than myself. But I realized that given the kind of career choices that I had taken, I was never going to fit in. This is not a question of superior, inferior. This is not that. But it's just that, first of all, my PhD topic was in a rather esoteric part of computer science. And there was not a lot of research that was going on in India at that point of time. Even now, it's not. Cybersecurity, you can say, yeah, sure, why not? But even when cybersecurity, when I tried, I found that there was really no desire. And there was the powers that be do not understand cybersecurity. And you can say, well, that's your job to make them. And maybe it's my failing, but I just can't. That's too much of a fight for me to do. And my vision that I wish I could have done, and again, I wanted to do a kind of a center for cybersecurity studies in one of the IIMs. And cybersecurity, not as a technical, there's a lot of technicalities, and I'm not saying that, I'm pretty sure that people have cybersecurity programs in India, but there is a much higher level problem in cybersecurity, which is really where the biggest bang for the buck can be realized. It's in the place of policy, governance, risk management, in essentially making companies understand the cost of cybersecurity, both in terms of what it means to their business, because that's really where the problem fundamentally lies. Because ultimately people come to, and that's why you have so many data breaches, so many cyber attacks. It's not that the technology to prevent them doesn't exist. Once you deconstruct the attacks, you would say, but this could easily have been prevented. There was nothing, the kind of hacking that you see in movies where you have like geniuses coming and breaking through things within minutes. That's not the way things actually happen. What happens are pretty mundane things, like in the case of the ransomware attack that happened over Labor Day. I think it's the meatpacking plant one. This was the Colonial Pipeline one. So the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, which I think $11 million or something they paid. The attack started because somebody was using a password which was already compromised in another breach. So this was essentially a case of credential stuffing. Now, there are standard countermeasures for this. And even if somebody was able to get in, there were other things. There were other countermeasures which should have engaged. So it evidently didn't. So the bigger problem isn't in technology. It's the question as to how much money do people spend and how much focus do they have on cybersecurity? Because unless something like this happens, people don't realize its value. It's a Colonial Pipeline is transports oil. They don't make cybersecurity products. So cybersecurity is not part of their business per se. It is some kind of stuff they have to do in order to ensure operations. But what is the model? How do you know you're spending the right amount of money? How do you know you're doing the right things technically? So that problem is one that definitely the entire world struggles with. But it's one that I believe companies in India will definitely struggle with, because even the kind of, because we don't, there's a policy issue, and I know I'm going way off tangent on the question, but this is what I really wanted to do, to influence the government to make sure that in a digital economy, we have protections for the privacy of our data. This often comes out as antagonism against something like Aadhaar, which really is antagonism against Modi, disguised as antagonism against data security. I'm absolutely for having greater standards, higher standards for data security. Doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything wrong with Aadhaar. Is there anything wrong with the government collecting data? You have a right as an individual to insist on security safeguards. That is absolutely right. And it's not just with government. It's the data which you give Pantaloons. It's the data that you gave Air India, which has been out on the dark web for years now. So this is the problem. And again, this problem isn't, you know, and as you can see, the pervasiveness of the problem should convince you that this is not based on individual incompetence. This is based on something fundamentally systemic. And that systemic thing cannot be solved unless we teach the next generation of managers and business leaders what cybersecurity is. And I don't mean encryption. I mean how to risk manage for cybersecurity in the exact same way they have courses in finance. They have courses in people know what the foreign exchange currency, what risk you get into. They know the risk from financial instruments. They know the body of knowledge there is fairly developed. There's absolutely nothing for cybersecurity. And that is what I felt that India needed. And I felt that I had done some work with respect to that. Not that I have a lot to learn myself. But then I realized that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to do that. So at that point of time, what would I do? So for me, coming back to the question, the notion of where you are in today's world, it's not important. It's not as important as it used to be in the 80s, where there was a huge difference in quality of life. I wouldn't say that my quality of life in the US is better than it would have been in India. So if people say people are migrating to US in droves because of quality of life, I wouldn't agree to that. I mean, maybe this was definitely the case in the 80s and the 90s, but I wouldn't say that now. I think the quality of life in India is at par in many ways is much better than what it is in the US. I mean, I definitely went, and you can say, well, that's because you go back to India for a few months. That could be true. But I definitely enjoy myself much more in India than I enjoy myself here in the US. But the only reason why I stay here is because, you know, I don't have to explain what I do here. I found that I could not explain myself in India. And that's why I'm here. If someday I'm able to, if people understand what I'm trying to say, people with power and people who've already are entrenched in power understand that, then yeah, there's nothing in US that keeps me here or if my writing takes off and I, you know, sell millions of copies of books, then yeah, there's not really a quality of life reason that makes me stay in the US. In the 80s and 90s, that was really the reason why people stayed in the US. Again, the question was perhaps more broad, but I can only answer it in my context. Okay, so I think we have come to the end of all the questions. So thanks a lot for whoever sent me questions. If you have more questions, please continue to send them, and I will try to answer them in a future iteration of the Attention Please podcast. Once again, for those of you who are not a Patreon subscriber, I would request that you consider being a monthly donor for the Attention Please podcast. If it's something that you like to listen to, if it's something that has become, as for some it has, part of their Monday listening, then please consider supporting the podcast but through any monthly contribution that you deem appropriate. The Patreon link is in the show notes, hopefully. It's just Patreon, Great Bong, Google it, you'll find it. So that's it. That's it for this episode of the podcast. Have a nice week.